Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. I want to thank you all so much for tuning in on what is turning out to be a relatively snowy March morning, which was a little unexpected, but hopefully wherever you are, you're staying safe, you're staying bundled, you're staying warm, and you're staying able to listen to this episode of Speak Up. To start off today, we're going to be playing an interview that I did last week with Vancouver artist, curator, writer Lorna Brown, who's recently awarded the Alvin Balkind Curator's Prize of 2025, presented by the Jack and Doris Shadbolt Foundation. This was an award that was awarded at the same time as the Viva Award, the Justine Chambers one. For those who tune in regularly, you'll know that I interviewed her about that award, and they're going to be honored at the same ceremony tomorrow night at the Vancouver Art Gallery. But I was able to speak with her not just about, you know, what it means for her to win this award at this point in her career, but also just to her general practice and how she goes about making the things that she does and curating the exhibitions that she curates. So without further ado, here is that conversation with myself and Lorna Brown.
Yes, my name is Lorna Brown, and I'm an artist and a curator, alum from SFU, class of 85. And I've been working in the Vancouver scene since then. Kind of working between a studio practice and visual art, curatorial practice, kind of starting in artist-run centers and collectives and cooperatives, and then later on in larger institutions such as the Morris and Helen Balkind Art Gallery out at UBC. And I also pretty committed to writing as well. So critical writing, writing about visual art, and writing about kind of various takes on contemporary art history.
Lovely. All right. Thank you very much for that introduction. And to start off the interview, the first question that I wanted to ask was just, what was that moment like for you, that just finding out that you were the winner of this prize? How did that feel? How did that sit?
Oh, it's delightful. It was like a really fantastic phone call and was a complete surprise. I received a call from Melanie O'Brien, who's the chair of the foundation, letting me know that that I was going to receive this award, wanting to know if I would accept it, which is, of course. And then she also let me know that this award is like a peer chosen award, which really means a lot. So it's actually three younger curators who nominated me.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, so the press around you winning this award talks about, you know, your curatorial innovation and scholarly research and critical reassessment of institutional forms. And then last bit, the critical reassessment of institutional forms. I'm curious if you can describe what that means to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it kind of refers to work that, in particular, that I did at the Balkind I was there for 6.5 years and retired in 2022, I think. But I did a series of exhibitions called Beginning with the 70s. And it looks at how archives, archivists, librarians, artists, media artists, how much their practices intersected in the social movements of the 70s and 80s. And so a lot of the curatorial project was to bring together artists and archivists to look at community archives, and also from an intergenerational perspective. So one example would be, as part of a show called Glut, I worked with a young artist, Ali Bischoff, and her project was to bring together the first inventory of the Vancouver Women's Bookstore, which was, I think, yeah, one of two first women's bookstores in Canada. So she got all of those books together from, I believe it was 1973. She also brought together all the founders. And it was set up in the gallery as a reading room with all of the covers facing out towards the viewer. It involved, we had couches and chairs for people to sit and read these books. And we also engaged readers to come in. So we're actually paid readers from a really broad range of backgrounds to come and engage with the books, and also to kind of intervene in them, like tipping in notes and that kind of thing. So that, as a kind of a curatorial practice, differs from, I guess, what would say institutional norms, in that it reached out to experts beyond, experts of life in a lot of ways, to directly to activists who were working politically and connected to artists working alongside those activists, as well as young artists and young activists. So bringing those things together. And that's like sort of one example of how I kind of approached, or we kind of approached archives. And the it kind of comes from a work that I did at the Vancouver Public Library. It was called Group Search Art in the Library, and that was commissioning artists to do create new works for the spaces in the Central Branch downtown, and also its systems. So Live One, an artist did a sort of intervention into the online catalog. The artists, you know, considered how books circulate, and when we were presenting the work in the library, it really struck me, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's really true, that libraries are these last kind of spaces of democracy. So we weren't, as artists, given any more privilege than any other group that wanted to present material within the library. So it kind of comes out of a belief that art is part of life. It should be in the public. It should be engaged with public life, and that should sort of aspire to bring public into the gallery. Think it is a public space, right? It can be a space like a library. It can be a space where the democratic principles of access and free speech can be realized. Does that help?
Yes, that definitely does help.
Okay.
That kind of ties into the next question I had, which had to do with another piece that you had worked on, Digital Natives, the public art piece, where part of it was like, you know, the public was seeing it on this big billboard, but then also the public was able to actively participate in it. And I'm wondering if public participation in art spaces and gallery spaces is something that you think there should be more of than maybe there is currently.
Yeah, I think opportunities for people to feel like the space is theirs to contribute is really important to me. And I think especially with Digital Natives, it was an electronic billboard that it was primarily a commercial space, like a commercial visual space. And, you know, in work that I've done, like say with the first collective I was involved in was called the Association for Non-Commercial Culture. And we would buy ad space on bus benches, bus shelters, et cetera, and have artists install images there. But, you know, it's always been sort of quite surprising to me that people are always willing to accept commercial visual images plastered all over public space. But with public art, it's like, why do you get to say something in this space? So there's, I think it's changed in the sense that there's a lot more public art out there now. And so the more there is, the more it's like a discourse between them rather than I'm against it or I hate that. And I think there's also a lot of people that enjoy public art, but, you know, don't write a letter to the editor. So anyway, the electronic billboard was a commercial space. So to intervene in that gave, you know, this prominent visual space to, I think it was around 60 artists and writers from around North America who sent their messages to us in the form of a Twitter message, like 144 characters. And then those messages were inserted. We purchased the space from the media company, the Time from the media company, and inserted those messages interspersed with the advertising content. That was for the first 2 weeks of the project. And in those 2 weeks, we gathered messages from the public. Those are represented as opposite colors. So they were red text on blue, whereas the artist's messages were blue text on red. And we also worked with First Nations folks to translate the messages into three First Nations languages. So, that led to some very interesting discourse with the media company. So the media company, first of all, within the contract, they can deny, deny any particular message. And it had to do with their sort of safety clauses. So if, for instance, they felt that it would cause a traffic accident because the billboard's right next to the bridge or that kind of thing. But they used that clause to pull several messages. One of them kind of referred to the history of colonization and the Olympics. And this was in the lead up to the Olympics. Another one referred to the relationship of First Nations to religious institutions. I can't remember what the third one was. So we didn't quite know how to handle that. There was no recourse with the media company. So in the end, what we did was reproduce those banned messages or censored messages on these like lawn signs, you know, for political parties. Mm-hmm. And the Burrard Street Bridge is the site of the, or was at that time, Vancouver Marathon. So the weekend of the marathon, we installed them on a little triangular piece of grass leading up onto, so they probably got higher visibility than if they had remained on the billboard itself. The response from the public was spontaneous and really gratifying, but it also included messages from youth groups that Clint Burnham, my co-curator, was holding during that time. So they generated messages, and I think that was the easiest way for us to see the effect, because the youth that were involved were really overwhelmed with the capacity to see their perspectives, you know, scaled up and in this very prominent location on the bridge.
Yeah, the way you described it too, I think one thing I find interesting is, you know, the media company being like, no, we can't have these messages for so-and-so reason, but like that wasn't like a hard to you, that didn't signify like, okay, I guess we can't do this, we can't share this message, we can't express this in any way. You just had to sort of find an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so much working in public spaces, negotiating all of these overlapping regulatory conditions. And so the collective that I continue to work with as part of the producer team is Other Sites for Artist Projects, and we do kind of a range of work in public space, but a lot of it is foregrounding for the public just how complex public space is in terms of overlapping jurisdictions and conditions, and you know how that we in public life we're kind of wandering across unmarked boundaries over and over and over again without really realizing they're there or why are they there historically. So with digital natives, for instance, we in the book publication and on the website, you know, we pointed out how that Kitsilano Squamish Reserve land had been shrunk over time down to this small triangular space that the bridge, you know, that underneath the bridge, essentially, which is now, of course, the site of the Sanok development, which is pretty amazing to see.
Do you feel like your perspective on curation has shifted from the beginning of your career to now?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, definitely. I think the curatorial projects that I was doing in the 90s, say with ArtSpeak. For one thing, ArtSpeak is it's an artist-run center in Gastown. It's a fairly modest size, and it has a particular mandate between visual art and writing. So that mandate and its sort of physical space really tended towards solo exhibitions or perhaps two-person exhibitions. So a way to kind of represent more of the community that surrounded an artistic practice was to do publications that were collaborations between artists and writers. And And also, you know, the part, an important function of artist-run centers is to, you know, provide space for artists to kind of have some autonomy and control the conditions of how their work is presented, how it's talked about, how it brings in the community. I think working in the larger space of the museum, quite often we see large solo shows in the civic galleries and museums. My focus was more about on group exhibitions and pulling work to be in conversation with one another, and to also, because of the larger scale in pretty much every way, it's possible to better represent the community that the work is coming from. So, for instance, with an exhibition called Hexam, To Be Here Always, a project where Marianne Nicholson and Althea Thauberger worked with the northern Kwakwaka'wakw community of Kinkum Inlet, where Marianne comes from, and involved a lot of people in the community in sort of the further development of different cultural practices. All of that kind of wound up in the museum. So, for instance, there was an exhibition, I think it was involved maybe, I think it was about 15 artists. But because of all this work that had been done in community, the her nation decided that they would launch a title suit against the crown, where they title would extend to not only their lands but also their waters. This had been in the works, obviously, for years and years. But on the occasion of the exhibition, a huge number of members of the community were able to come down, file the suit in the morning at the courthouse, and then have the celebration at the gallery itself. So essentially handing over the institution to a community for its, you know, as a venue or as a site to further its interests, I think is something that I found really exciting. That was a huge moment, I think, for me and for them.
Yeah, a huge moment in like recontextualizing or rethinking the ways in which things like that can occur. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what is a contemporary art space for? I mean, it still holds on to the what's really valuable about it as like a space of contemplation in contemporary life, because there's not very many of those anymore. And yet it can also become this site for cultural work in the broadest possible sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Writing is a big part of your practice. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had thoughts on, I guess, just the way in which writing is often conveyed and used as like a way of describing gallery spaces or exhibits. And I a few days ago, I'd actually spoken with Justine Chambers about the award that she had won. And in that conversation, she had talked about how, like, you know, writing can often be like a tool for like inaccessibility in some of these spaces, mm-hmm. where it's you know, you if you go into a gallery space and you read the sort of writing on the wall of what this exhibition is and you can't really follow what it says, then it's like there's no sort of middle ground. It's kind of like, okay, you don't get it, this isn't for you then. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are in terms of gallery spaces and just the art ecosystem of not just Vancouver, but I guess North America in general.
Yeah, it's interesting because on the one hand, like I'm not a scholar, really. I'm coming to curation and from an artistic practice and not trained as an art historian in any way or as a scholar. I mean, the term curator is a very malleable thing, as we've seen. On the one hand, I do really respect scholarship and scholarly language because its aim is to be really precise. And I respect that. And I think, like any kind of specialized language, heavy truck mechanics is a specialized discourse. If I picked up that manual and tried to understand, I would feel this is not for me. On the other hand, I do think institutions like galleries and museums have a responsibility to the public in translating the concepts from that scholarship into plain language, into clear language, or to provide opportunities through tours and other to kind of crack it open a little bit and allow for the last thing an institution should want to do is to impede people's curiosity. Like people come in and they're reading means they're curious and they want to know more. So it's a balance. And I think, at the Belkin, it's a university gallery. But I felt during my time there that it was really important to think about the community as a whole. During that time, they began doing programming for kids a couple times a year, and that carries on because there's a community out there, like there are families, and actually that gallery was very popular with families. So through this sort of additional programming, I think there's a way to be welcoming. One thing that really struck me, is talking to you about the rereading room, Ali Bischoff's project with the women's bookstore inventory. One of the readers hadn't gone to university and had never felt in any way kind of welcome on a university campus. And that was her response to the process of being engaged to come and read these books. She talked a lot about that, how the spaces of the academy, like trying to figure out what exactly or where exactly she could locate her discomfort in the space. How was it physically? What were its kind of conditions, architecturally in all of these other ways? And it was really fascinating. So I guess what we're trying to do is find ways to reward that curiosity, but also to respect the precision of scholarly approaches and scholarly language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just trying to strike that balance of adhering and respecting the precision and scholarly work that goes into any sort of project, but then also mm-hmm. making sure that the people that want to engage with it and that have that curiosity are met as well.
Yeah. Yeah.